Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is the daughter of Chico State English professor Clark Brown, who wrote two books about Chico. Liz Brown's book is a family history involving her great-granduncle, William Clark, Jr. Her book is Twilight Man, Love and Ruin in the Shadows of Hollywood and the Clark Empire. It's a story of a forbidden romance, a stolen fortune, betrayal, and fraud. Liz Brown, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, your ancestor had a role in the fact that we have a 17th Amendment to the Constitution. Wow.
It's true. Yeah.
How did that come about?
That came about the way a lot of fortunes in this country came about through dubious means of hoarding resources. And we're talking about the Clarks, that is, the Clark family that was known mostly as a copper mining family in dynasty, I should say, copper mining dynasty in Montana. And Clark Sr., William Andrews Clark Sr., was the patriarch, the wizard of this incredible dynasty and empire. And he was also corrupt in that he would pay for judges, for politicians. And the one thing he really wanted was to be a senator. And he paid his way into the Senate, bribing his way. At that time, senators were not popularly elected. They weren't elected by popular vote, but by state legislatures. So he could, it was easier to bribe your way. And because he was so flagrant in his corruption, they instituted the 17th Amendment to make Senate elections a popular vote.
My guest is Liz Brown, and she has written a family history, a true story, amazing true story. And she has just told us how we happened to get the 17th Amendment due to the actions of an ancestor of hers. So he was not a saint.
No, he wasn't. But, you know, I think he was known as the most corrupt man in America. There were all these names for him. And but in some ways, I think he wasn't good at being corrupt because everyone knew it. You know, a really corrupt person, you would never know. So I think in some ways, he actually was too flagrant and he was too obvious in his paying off judges and lawyers and in paying off judges and lawyers and other politicians. So he kind of ruined it for the other senators who had figured out how to be more surreptitious. In fact, they used to call the Senate, I think they used to call it the Millionaires Club, because it was basically many other people like Clark who had kind of bought their way into the Senate.
And I might mention by way of a time frame that this 17th Amendment was passed in 1913. Also, there's a county in Nevada named Clark. Mm-hmm.
That is for the Clarks. Yes, Clark County, Nevada, Clarkdale, Arizona is also for the Clark family. They're associated with Montana, but their mining operation was all over the country. And they had other things, sugar beets, newspapers, timber. They had their fingers in lots of different industries.
Well, I'd like to go back a little bit before 1913, the 17th Amendment. And how did you have an ancestor that made it to Montana?
So and this is a circuitous story. So my grandmother's aunt, her name was Alice McManus, and she was a telephone operator in Butte, Montana, and met William Clark Jr., who was the son of the richest man. And they started a romance and got married. And that is how my story connects to the Clark story. So it's not a blood relation. It's through marriage. And she was known as a hello girl. That's what they called the operator, the women who answered the phones at that time.
Well, that kind of brings me to the question of what gave you the idea to undertake all the research involved in writing this book?
Sure. Yeah, my mom would tell stories about the Clarks and my grandmother's Uncle Will, and he was always an interesting shadowy figure. And I never quite understood the connection until I started digging in, because it was so far in the past and it was such a circuitous connection. But I knew there were rumors that he was gay or that he had male lovers, and I was very intrigued by that. I had, in my 20s, I had come out to my family as gay, and it had been a very difficult experience and took them a while to accept that. And so there was a real impasse for a while. And during that time, in a way, I tried to find another family connection. I knew there was this gay ancestor. And so I was really intrigued, because in my present day, family interaction was somewhat fraught. So I was looking for other connections, and I did not expect to find as much as I did, and as complicated and as juicy a story as I did.
My guest is Liz Brown, and she has written a book that is a family history. The title of her book is Twilight Man. And I just imagine that you probably didn't know what you were getting into when you started this research. Did you, Liz?
In fact, no.
You were naive, might be the word to describe you.
Oh, if I had understood what was coming, I don't know if I would have done it. You know, I didn't. I thought it'll be 2 years. It was not 2 years.
And who is this person? He's on the cover of your book, Twilight Man. Who is that? Describe the cover of your book for us, Liz.
Yes, it is a darkly handsome matinee idol looking man from the 20s, and his name is Harrison Post. And I found that photo in my grandmother's dresser a few days after her funeral. She had lived to be 96 and had died 2003. And I was in her home in San Francisco looking through things, and I found this incredible, glamorous photo. And I thought he was a movie star. And it was inscribed to her. It said to Alice, that was her name, from Harrison with the good wishes. And I thought she must have been a teenager sending away for an autographed movie star's photo. And then later, when I was researching my Uncle Will, discovered Harrison had been his secret lover. And there are so many sort of wishful moments, but one is that I found this photo after my grandmother was gone, and I could never ask her what she knew about him or why she had kept that photo for 80 years.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising that he would be a movie star, because they lived in LA. They had friends, Greta Garbo, for example. That was before you found out who he really was. And the title of your book, Twilight Man, Love and Ruin in the Shadows of Hollywood and the Clark Empire. Now, this empire was, it was a golden age then that your ancestor was living in. So would you read a little bit of this book? In your book, it starts, "Few people in America have been born into such riches," and your family, your ancestors were quite wealthy. Would you read a little bit from your book, Liz?
Sure. "Few people in America have been born into such riches, and yet Will's first year was marked by sorrow. He was only a few months old when his 2-year-old sister, Jessie, contracted pneumonia. She died in April 1878, weeks after his first birthday. Montana may have been the origin of the Clark's phenomenal fortune, but it was also where the family buried 2 children. That fall, they sailed for France. Paris was in the midst of its own boom, having emerged from the Battle of the Commune. In the Tuileries, gardeners tended the once scorched, now blooming gardens. Up on Montmartre, workmen toiled on the white dome of the Sacré-Cœur. Hot air balloons floated above the Seine. Will and his family arrived in a city newly illuminated with arc lights. Far from the belching smokestacks and pits of roasting ore, 13 million people flocked to the Exposition Universelle, where they heard Alexander Graham Bell's telephone ring and Thomas Edison's phonograph warble. In the Trocadero Gardens, visitors walked inside the colossal copper head of the Statue of Liberty, the Republic's new gift to commemorate America's abolition of slavery and its embrace of independence. Just a few months later, Edison patented the incandescent light bulb. The electrification of the world had already begun, and now the pace accelerated. Telegraph wires, telephone lines, light sockets, all needed the red ductile metal that Will's father was pulling from the earth. Or rather, his legions of miners were extracting, doing the dangerous, poisonous work of scraping and plunging and smelting, while acrid green smog filled the air in Butte and sulfuric soot settled on the grass and coated the windowsills, and the Clark fortune continued to swell.
Well, now right there, you tell us why he became so wealthy. You describe this red ductile metal that Will's father was pulling out of the earth, or his miners were, and so that's where he made his fortune, and that's how he could afford to go to France.
Yes. For 13 centuries, from the coronation of Clovis I until Louis XVI was stripped of his title in 1792, France had had a king. Since then, the country had roiled between revolution and backlash, republic and empire, until finally after the disastrous Franco-Prussian War, Napoleon III was deposed. The French monarchy might be over, but the imperial impulse still lived on. It wasn't driven by the divine right of kings, but of capital. America called itself a republic, but as W.A. Clark Sr. proved, if a man owned enough of its resources, along with its banks, postal services, and utilities, he might as well consider himself sovereign.
My guest is Liz Brown. She's reading from her book, Twilight Man, Love and Ruin in the Shadows of Hollywood and the Clark Empire. So we learn that he goes over to France, but he doesn't spend all his time there. He comes back to the United States. And the Clark children were over there 6 years before it was time for them to come back to America and to learn their own language. And so your ancestor could afford art. He became an art collector there because he could afford it.
Yes, yes. Among the vestiges of faded empires, Will's father could imbue his new world wealth with old world prestige. He gathered up the remnants of the bygone dynasties to decorate his palace back in Butte, tapestries, rugs, vases, ceramics. While his wife remained with their children, cosseted by nannies and governesses and tutored in French and German, W.A. began a ritual of seasonal migration. He spent most of the year in America, presiding over his growing kingdom, returning each winter to his family. 6 years passed, and it was deemed time for the Clark children to come back to America, to learn their own language, to discover how much they possessed. 20 years before, Will's father had driven a team of oxen from Missouri to Colorado, when the nation was 25 states wrenched apart by war. Now it had been knit back together, and it stretched from one end of the continent to the other. The railroads hurtled people and goods across the land, prosperity bloomed, and much of it belonged to Will's family. And so the day came when his mother took him to Grand Central and sent him off alone across the country to Los Angeles, where his grandmother lived and his aunt ran a school. At the end of the journey, when the boy finally arrived, he alighted at a two-story wooden depot surrounded by freight yards, pasture land, and mountains. It was quieter than Paris, quieter than New York, quieter than Butte. Not that Will would have had much memory of the raucous mining town. Los Angeles had grown at a different pace from the rest of the country. No waterway or harbor had designated it a strategic spot for trade. No mineral rushes had swept through. No smokestacks. Adjacent to the frontier, but apart from the boom, Los Angeles had idled. It was a ranching town. The mining years had been good ones. The demand for beef in the foothills had been constant. But these pastures weren't a destination for fortune seekers. A small housing boom had spurted and fizzled a decade before. The former Pueblo's rhythms belonged not to the incessant churn of industry, but to seasons, to grazing schedules and harvests.
In some of these sections where you're describing the situation, how could you have known, like when you described the what happened to the opening of the Philharmonic, you say when the boy arrived in Los Angeles, he alighted at a two-story wooden depot surrounded by freight, so on. So you had to use your imagination to fill in some of your descriptions, did you not?
I actually did research and find out what the train station looked like at that time. And I could give you a whole sidebar about the sequence of how the Arcade Station became Central Station, became Union Station, you know, and how it moved around. For the most part, it is a lot of research that I would corroborate or dig through to make sure I was correct. There are a couple times where I allowed myself to speculate a little bit or to embroider. But for the most part, it was a lot of research.
Well, later on in your book, you described the opening of the Philharmonic because your grandfather, your great-grandfather, uncle rather.
Great-grandfather.
Yeah, was... He founded it, and mm-hmm. there's a sentence in that section where you say, a trombone caught the light, a flare
yes.
flashed across the auditorium, Rothel's shoulders jerked and his arms spread wide, pulling sound through the air. How could you know that, Liz?
I couldn't. You absolutely. That's one section. There were a couple sections, and they were sort of, I chose them as moments when Harrison, when the main character, the main figure, Harrison, is in a transition, is in some mm-hmm. kind of, mm-hmm. something is shifting in his life. So that was a moment when his world opens up and he arrives in LA and attends the launch of the LA Philharmonic. Another section is when everything falls apart and he, through very strange machinations on his sister's part, is taken captive. That part I completely allowed myself that moment to imagine what it might be like to be taken captive and subject to that.
My guest is Liz Brown, and she has written a book called Twilight Man. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Liz Brown, who's the daughter of Chico State English professor Clark Brown. Her book is Twilight Man. Now, well, you've just mentioned this guy that we've talked about, the photograph on the cover, and the person that you write about in the book is Harrison Post. But that was not the young man that your great-uncle met, your great-granduncle met.
Yes.
And who was this person that he met?
The person he met was originally named Albert Weiss Harrison, and he was the son of a Jewish clothing salesman. And he was, I think, 21 when he met Will Clark, who was 42, and he was working as a shop clerk in San Francisco at a luxury emporium. This is 1919. And he had a foster mother named Mary Post. And so he took his father's last name and his foster mother's last name and reinvented himself as Harrison Post. And I think of him as kind of a great, I think of him as a gay Great Gatsby, a man who just completely reinvented himself through money, through someone else's money. Gatsby, actually, his fortune originally comes from a mining magnat as well. And then Harrison is able to reinvent himself from shop clerk to into this Hollywood socialite.
My guest is Liz Brown, and her book is Twilight Man, and she's just told us who this Twilight Man is. And why did you label him Twilight Man, Liz?
Yes, that is a term that I was not familiar with, but it was in the 30s, it was used for gay men. It was a term for gay men. And I came across it in a book I found called The Clarks, An American Phenomenon, which is really the first book that was written about the Clarks in the 40s. And it's a very scandalous tell-all by a very disgruntled former employee. And I'd have no idea how much of it is factual because it is such a bitter, angry book, but it is fascinating. And in that book, the author, whose name was William Mangum, refers to Harrison, he refers to him as an Oscar Wilde type, and as the type known as a Twilight Man. And that was the first time I ever came across that term. And it felt right for this shadowy figure that you never quite get a handle on, that he manages to slip through all these different classes and worlds. And it felt fitting for Harrison's story.
Well, you know, this fairy tale that you've written, fairy tales have villains. And who are the villains in your fairy tale, Liz?
The villains are Harrison's sister. Her name was Gladys, and her husband, Charles. He was a car salesman from Toledo, and his name was Charles Crooks. And so they were the Crooks.
This car salesman and Harrison's sister, their last name is Crooks.
It's the kind of thing you wouldn't get away with in fiction.
No, if you were writing fiction, people are like, what?
That's too much. It's too far. Yeah. But they... I should back up and say Harrison arrives in L.A. and in 1919, a few years later, his sister Gladys shows up. And then a few years later, this car salesman from Toledo shows up. They meet in the nightlife of LA. And then Harrison had a stroke or some kind of nervous breakdown. It's unclear. He was having health complications. And right after that happened, Will Clark dies suddenly of a heart attack. And Harrison's sister Gladys swoops in, has him declared incompetent, and proceeds to take over the estate that had been left to Harrison.
You know, you just mentioned that he died, when he died of a heart attack. And something that I found interesting was that a long time before he died, he had a mausoleum designed. And when you told me where he was buried and in L.A., and it was he wasn't the only famous resident of this cemetery in L.A., Hollywood Forever, called Hollywood Forever Cemetery. There's a local writer here in Chico. He's a photographer, and he writes books about cemeteries. His name is Douglas Keister. And so I thought, well, I'll bet Doug has a photograph, a color photograph, because you have a lot of photographs in your book, but they're black and white.
Right.
So I took Douglas Keister's book, Forever LA, off the shelf. It's a field guide to Los Angeles area cemeteries. And here is this beautiful color photograph, the mausoleum of William A. Clark. And Doug explains that he's the founder of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. And this mausoleum sits on an island in the middle of a pond. The elegant classical revival family mausoleum was built in 1920, well before his death in 1934. And it was designated the most beautiful monument constructed between 1925 and 1928 by the Architectural Society of America. And you may not have known that about your ancestor's mausoleum.
I did not. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So I found that interesting. So I was doing my own little bit of research, too, as I was reading your book. Now, since I mentioned this mausoleum, I had wondered when I first was looking at it, I thought, well, I wonder if Liz went there. But you absolutely did. And, oh, boy, was that an interesting section of your book. In fact, if you don't mind, can we skip ahead to that? This is later in your book where you go. This is in July of 2011 when you went to Will's mausoleum. Would you read us a little bit of that?
Sure. It was a dry, hot day in July, but inside the tomb, the air was cool. This was the summer of 2011 when I was trying out life in Los Angeles before I would come back to California 2 years later. My parents had come down from Chico to visit. We were all trying out new ways to be that summer. We'd spent the morning at the Clark Library, whispering in the reading room, paging through the guest books from the Mauitsa Lodge and photographs of my grandmother as a child with her aunt and uncle. We continued the pilgrimage, if that's the word for it, to Hollywood Forever Cemetery, driving through the wrought iron gates on Santa Monica Boulevard and parking beside the green lawn. The official line was that only direct descendants were allowed in William Andrew Clark Jr.'s mausoleum, but someone in charge was persuaded by my mother's explanation of our circuitous family connection and agreed to take us inside. There aren't, in fact, any direct descendants, and I wondered if the employees, curious like us, welcomed an excuse to pull open the big bronze door. In any case, we piled into a golf cart and sped past several peacocks preening on the lawn. Inside the cold tomb, we were quiet, but this was a different hush. This was different from the hush in the library, where archivists pad through the carpeted reading room to deliver manuscripts to waiting scholars. Our footsteps echoed against the marble. Only four people are interred here: Will, Mabel, Alice, and Tertius. The man who'd opened the doors broke the moment with a nod to one of the still empty marble sarcophagi. "There's room if anyone wants." My mother shook her head. None of us wanted to stay. Everyone's going to die. Of course, we know this, but Chris Kardashian reminds us in the seventh season of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. In this particular episode, the matriarch of the reality TV empire attempts to address the subject of mortality with her family. She calls her daughters to discuss the topic, but each one hangs up as soon as she can. Her son, Rob, recoils too. "Cremated or buried?" she asks him. "Buried," he says. End of conversation. Chris wants to make plans, but nobody else does, so she seeks out someone who will take her seriously. Noelle Berman, spokeswoman for Hollywood Forever Cemetery. In the offices on Santa Monica Boulevard, Chris waits for the others to arrive. Kim comes in first. Noelle tries to suppress her giddiness, but a small smile still flits across her face. Finally, the rest assemble, and just like my parents and I did the year before, the Kardashians pile into a golf cart on their way to Will Clark's tomb. The family is full of plans. We should build a mausoleum by a lake. We want our own lake, and we want like a moat.
Now, just a second, Liz. You're going there to see your ancestors' mausoleum, and lo and behold, did you have any idea you would be meeting the Kardashians?
Oh, I didn't. We didn't meet them. This is from an episode a year later.
Oh,
sorry,
yeah.
Sorry for that confusion. But I definitely did not expect that overlap to happen at all. But in some ways, it makes sense. The Clarks were, in their time, the Kardashians. We don't know their names the way we know the Kardashians now, but they definitely had a pull on the media attention, and they had an empire of their own.
Okay, well, go ahead then with what you're saying then about the Kardashians.
The Kardashians are not direct descendants of Will Clark either, but the cemetery opened the mausoleum for them. They walk across the bridge to the island, and soon they're inside, voices bouncing off the marble. Chris muses about how each Kardashian would have each Kardashian would have their own section of the mausoleum. And then, to try this out, she clambers up on my aunt's coffin and lies there. Until then, I'd been on Chris's side, agreeing that conversations about death are hard but necessary. However, once she's up there on my aunt's tomb, my rage comes fast and hot. It's the first time I think my aunt, and it's the first time I feel the distance between all the generations collapse, and I am furious.
Now, is this accurate here? I mean, this is true that you're furious?
Well, in the moment when I'm watching that episode of the show and I see Chris Kardashian climb up on the tomb, I just had such a feeling of violation, mm-hmm. of sort of this is sacred space, even though I hadn't really, I still had felt the kind of disconnect from this family of the Clarks, but I still just instinctively in that moment felt this anger rise up.
Because you felt your aunt was disrespected.
Yes. But it was also a funny moment because then, you know, there are other members of the family that, of course, stand, you know, say this is disrespectful. So then I also felt, I felt protected, or I felt rather that someone had my position. So
there's so many characters in the book that we haven't gotten a chance to mention. And I ask you about the villains in your book, and you even include Will as a villain. In what way? How is he a villain? You know, here's this nice musician. He was shy. And so how did you come to think of him as, in a sense, a villain?
There are... Let me think about this. One of the storylines in this book that I am not able to get to the bottom of, and it's can only ever be speculation, is his relationship with his housekeeper and her son, who I forget how old the boy was when Will hired her. But his name was George Palais, and he ends up inheriting a lot of Will's estate, as does Harrison. But George, let me think. Will had a son named William Andrews Clark III. They called him Tertius, and he had died in 1932 in an airplane accident. And George kind of became a surrogate son for Will, but there were rumors and speculation that it was not an entirely above board relationship. It was that that Will's interest in the boy might have gone beyond just a fatherly or paternal concern. That is something I feel very uncomfortable, or I guess I'm trying to be very delicate about that, because there's nothing anyone can know about that relationship. But there was a lot of speculation at the time about what that dynamic was. And there's a way that when I look back on Will's father's relationship with his second wife, who was quite young when they got married, and there was a huge age, there was about 40-year age difference. You know, I start to see a kind of trajectory in the family that you might think of in, say, kings and having concubines or mistresses, or that these young people who don't come from money end up pulled into the orbit and groomed or taken advantage of in some way. That and so that shadow hangs over the story, and it makes it difficult to just purely see him as this benevolent figure. And that was that is why I sort of think these were wealthy people who, as generous as they could be, I think they also didn't see other people always as equals, but as people you purchase.
My guest is Liz Brown, and her book, Twilight Man, Love and Ruin in the Shadows of Hollywood and the Clark Empire. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Liz Brown. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Liz Brown, who has written a book about love and ruin in the shadows of Hollywood and the Clark Empire. Now, I just referred to Will, and you've been talking about your ancestors. So maybe it would be helpful for the listeners to kind of keep the three people with the same names, and you refer to them a little differently to keep them, help us keep track of them. But who are these three people with the same, who share the name?
So the first one is William Andrews Clark Sr., and he was the patriarch and the head of the Clark dynasty. And he was the mastermind of this incredible fortune that was built out of the copper mining empire. And his son was William Andrews Clark Jr. In the book, I refer to him as Will. And Will's son was William Andrews Clark III. And his name was Tertius. That's how people referred to him.
Since he was the third.
Yeah. Exactly.
So we have three men with the same name, and the one who started the empire. And then Will, he had his golden age. We're looking at, say, 1919 to 1926, would you say, for Will's golden age, if I want to call it that?
I think definitely to 26, maybe a little bit further, but that moment, the first half of the 20s, is just this efflorescence. He founds the LA Philharmonic.
The Hollywood Bowl.
he gives a lot of money to the Hollywood Bowl, and he essentially gives the Hollywood Bowl the LA Philharmonic for their talent. He wasn't the visionary behind the Bowl, but it would not have become what it is today without that collaboration between the LA Phil, without that collaboration with the LA Philharmonic. He also founded the Clark Library, which of course isn't as well known as the LA Phil or the Hollywood Bowl, but is a wonderful library here in LA that is now part of UCLA, and it has the largest collection of material related to Oscar Wilde and a lot of other really wonderful collections there too.
Well, I asked you earlier about who some of the villains were in your book, and you mentioned Harrison's sister and her husband, and he finally got away. It took to like 1936 when Harrison was able to get away. He left LA and went on a cruise. And now I want to remind people when this time period is. So he left, he sailed out of Jamaica, and this is April of 1937. He sailed out of Jamaica for Copenhagen. And where did he end up?
He ends up in Norway, and he goes to Norway because he has a male nurse named Oscar Tryggestad, who's from Norway. And my theory is that Oscar was trying to help Harrison get out of the clutches of his sister. And so they go to Oscar's hometown in Norway, which is a tiny little town on a fjord.
Hellesylt? I've never heard of Hellesylt, but
Hellesylt, yes, yeah. That's the name. It's beautiful, beautiful town.
Yeah, so off he goes, and he likes Hellesylt. And what happens to him there?
He thinks he's going to settle in and have a nice, easy life and recover from all the horrible things that just happened. But the Nazis invade, and he is taken captive by the Nazis. He's becomes a prisoner of war and put in prisoner of war camps. He's put in internment camps, first in Norway, and then he's taken to Germany, where he ends up in a camp in Laufen in Bavaria.
I might remind people that he is Jewish.
And that is, it's a fascinating moment because he has both the worst luck and the best luck. He has the worst luck to be a Jewish man in Nazi-occupied Norway.
In the late 1930s.
But he doesn't identify as Jewish. And he talks about this great wealth he has back in America. And he behaves like he is still a millionaire. And my theory is that it's that sort of performance of wealth, which I think he believed, but wasn't actually real. It was all gone by that time. That made the Nazis feel that he was still an important American and they couldn't send him off to the death camps, which one of the commanders very clearly wanted to do.
So here he is. He goes to Norway in 1938. And this gay Jewish man survives the Nazis.
It's an incredible piece of luck and so strange. And one of the amazing finds was a prisoner of war memoir, a Norwegian prisoner of war memoir that includes a chapter on him. And it blew my mind that I found it was in Norwegian and I had to have it translated, but it just blew my mind that I found him in this book and was able to kind of recreate what had happened to him. And he does survive and he comes back to America, where he discovers Gladys and Charles Crooks have fled to Mexico City.
Well, now you actually did the traveling yourself. Besides going to Butte, Montana, you went to Norway and Germany yourself as you were researching your book.
Yes, I went to Norway and to Germany, and it was really an amazing experience to walk in the path that he had been in. And I met two people there who were in their 80s who remembered him, because pretty much everybody else had passed away. So all of my resources were legal files and journals. They weren't people, except for these two people who had been children in Hellasilt. And they both made the same, I met them separately, and they both made the same, they both told the same story, in essence, about him. They each described how particular he was about his clothing, and how he would go to the tailor and and they both made the same gestures with their hands, indicating where the sleeves should fall on the wrists, and that Harrison was so meticulous about his clothes. And I just thought it was amazing that these people who had been children in their 80s had the exact same story to tell about this strange American who ended up in their tiny town.
Well, I feel we barely scratched the surface of your story, Liz. I want to tell people again the title of your book, Twilight Man, Love and Ruin in the Shadows of Hollywood and the Clark Empire. And the author is Liz Brown. Thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you, Nancy.
Chico humorist Eric Miller, a.k.a. Etc. Guy, retired from the garbage business and now has time for outdoor pursuits and writing with the North State Writers Group. And now here's Eric Miller.
Hi, Nancy. I have a hockey story for you. This one's entitled Hockey Bomb's Excuse Scores Hat Trick, and it appeared in a magazine a few years back. The five of us frowned as we tied our skates. We were down two players and knew the next 45 minutes would test our lungs and legs. Where's Blaze? Swifty asked. At a Raider game, I answered. Good excuse. Better than when Chuck got lost hunting or when Lefty had his vasectomy. Those guys had the lamest excuses. Yeah, how did Chuck get lost hunting birds? I already fell asleep in a duck blind. I can understand Lefty skipping work, but it's unforgivable to miss a game. So what if he was sore? My tomcat hunted gophers an hour after getting neutered. Swifty laughed. A shorthanded team is as vulnerable as a three-legged dog. Opposing teams drool when there's an opportunity to massacre undermanned teams. It's like Custer's last stand, except that the annihilation occurs on a hockey rink instead of prairie grass. Our co-ed inline hockey league includes California natives and ice hockey transplants from colder climates. We've traded blades for wheels because our nearest ice sits frozen on either Sierra Nevada mountaintops or inside garage freezers. League players include college students, moms, and dads. The ladies, who are outnumbered in our league, skate hard and have the respect of the guys. It's not surprising to see ponytails flailing behind helmets. Some guys also wear ponytails, though, like Crazy Pete, a goalie. Goalies are off-kilter anyway. Each team has seven players, perfect for 4-on-4 hockey, but it's critical everyone shows up. A roster of five means doom, and four is an automatic loss, even if skaters have elephant lungs. We greet one another before games, curse each other during combat, and shake hands afterwards. We thrive on competition and hate missing games. My pregame routine includes strapping on knee braces. Years ago, I endured a forced sabbatical from sports when I tore my anterior cruciate ligament, or ACL. Blaze sat out 10 months after tearing his ACL. Other players miss games due to strained muscles or broken bones. Lousy excuses for missing games include staying home to stack wood, nurse hangovers, or rotate tires. I even rescheduled my colonoscopy to avoid missing a game. That stuff can wait. Hall passes are granted for celebrating kids' birthdays or anniversaries. When hockey players miss those, we suffer terrible consequences at home. Probably the most unique excuse came from JT Flyer, a hockey mom. I saw her during the summer break. Hey, I didn't see your ponytail last spring. Missed a season, she said. Had surgery. I instantly reflected on my knee surgery. I hadn't realized she got hurt. That's awful. Was it your knee? Higher. Shoulder? Lower. Wrist? Try again. I have a working knowledge of female body parts, but was losing this guessing game. Our conversation was becoming clinical and socially awkward. I was dumbfounded and wondered what ailed her. We all have our fragile areas, but I hadn't noticed any black eyes, crutches, or missing teeth. It was my uterus. Pardon? You heard me, the reproductive organ where hockey players come from. We didn't evolve from sea animals, you know? I gawked at JT like a deer staring at headlights. I didn't want to come across as an insensitive oaf. When hockey players harass referees, we get penalties, and I don't want an interference call from JT. I dug deep into my soul and searched my one feeling for the right words or word. Bummer. JT grinned, realizing she got the best of me. Guys aren't tough enough to have uteruses. Men give the worst excuses for missing games. JT nearly scored a hat trick. Not only did she get it in the last word, but she gave an excuse I've never heard or experienced. It wasn't on my radar. Athletes at all levels understate their vulnerabilities. They're too focused on the camaraderie and spirit of competition. Regardless of gender, we are all vulnerable in areas we can't even see. I won't pass judgment on a comrade's excuse for missing games. Life happens and sometimes gets in the way of hockey, but I sure miss my friends when they're not playing. I'm Eric Miller.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Ode to Beethoven. Ludwig, dude, I remember your joy, screams, moans, sighs, hysterical laughs, praise for trees, birds, sun, rain. I sat at my piano, age 10, made my fingers bring you to life. Death surrounded me. Aged aunts, cousins, uncles always fell. I cringed, shrank from clawed hands that reached for me from the gray corners. You became my shelter, my strength. I was often a happy kid. Me and my gang thrived on forest hikes, swimming holes in creeks, hide and seek under streetlights, baseball at dusk, cheering the pirates from bleachers. We created tales where Hercules and Tarzan rallied lions, elephants, zebras, giraffes, joined us kids to attack those clawed hands and drive them from our world. When I was alone, stalked by colorless shadows, with no friends to fight gloom with laughter, I sang you. My fingers skipped along shining keys, Moonlight Sonata, Fear Elise. I stalled, stumbled, but you still built a shield that blocked claws. Ecstatic warrior, we still dance. Paul Belts.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.